With rapid changes in food science, farming technology, and government regulation, your work as a food safety leader is more important than ever. Advance your career with a Master of Science in Food Safety from Michigan State University. This program is taught completely online and is designed for you, the working professional. Michigan State University, preparing students to tackle the challenges of today and tomorrow. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the Master's Program link to learn more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine and one of the hosts of our podcast. Thank you for joining us for week 3 of our special coverage for National Food Safety Education Month here in the U.S., where we're looking back on some of the seminal events that have shaped food safety by driving regulatory change and have been memorialized in books. This week, we're discussing Jeff Benedict's 2011 book, Poisoned, that chronicles the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak of 1993 through the experiences of attorney Bill Marler, who represented victims of the outbreak. We're very pleased to have Bill Marler, subject of the book and the most prominent foodborne illness attorney in the U.S., here to discuss these events with our editorial director, Adrian Bloom. Now, many feel that the Jack in the Box outbreak ushered in the modern era of food safety. And if you haven't already read the book, I would highly recommend that you do. I'll share with you that Poisoned is required reading for new team members here at Food Safety Magazine. We found it very useful to help people quickly understand what's at stake when we say food safety and what the implications of failure are. The book also brings into real focus the work that was done by colleagues we know and celebrate as food safety heroes. It also shows what can be accomplished when we work together to protect public health. Before we get started, here's a proper introduction of our guest. Bill Marler is an accomplished attorney and national expert in food safety, who's become the most prominent foodborne illness lawyer in America with his firm Marler Clark, the food safety law firm, and a major force in food policy in the U.S. as well as around the world. For the past 26 years, Bill has represented victims of nearly every large foodborne illness outbreak in the U.S. He began litigating foodborne illness cases in 1993 when he represented Breanne Kiner, the most seriously injured survivor of the historic Jack in the Box E. coli 0157H7 outbreak in her landmark $15.6 million settlement with the company. Bill's advocacy for a safer food supply includes petitioning the U.S. Department of Agriculture to better regulate pathogenic E. coli, working with nonprofit food safety and foodborne illness victims organizations, and helping spur the passage of the 2010-2011 FDA Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA. His work has led to invitations to address local, national, and international gatherings on food safety, including testimony before the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce. Bill also gives frequent donations to industry groups for the promotion of improved food safety and has established numerous collegiate science scholarships in the U.S. He's also a frequent writer on topics related to foodborne illness, and is the publisher of the online news site Food Safety News and his award-winning blog, MarlerBlog.com. He's a frequent media guest on food safety issues and has been profiled in numerous publications. And we're very pleased to have him join us today. And now, here's that interview.
So this week, for National Food Safety Education Month, we are looking into the deadly 1993 E. coli outbreak in ground beef served at 73 Jack in the Box restaurants. Now, this outbreak claimed the lives of 4 children, permanently injured 178 others, and sickened hundreds of other people across 4 states. It also led to regulatory changes by the USDA to declare E. coli an illegal adulterant in ground beef. Now, author Jeff Benedict wrote about the 1993 Jack in the Box outbreak and the ensuing legal, industry, and political battles that followed in his book, Poisoned. Benedict takes a prominent focus on attorney Bill Marler's defense of Breanne Kiner, the most seriously injured survivor of the outbreak, as well as hundreds of other victims in a class action suit against the parent company, Foodmaker. Settlements for the individual and class action suits reached over $50 million, which is the largest payment related to foodborne illness at the time. Now, I'm here today with Bill Marler to discuss the events surrounding that 1993 outbreak and the book Poisoned. Since the 1993 outbreak, Bill has become the most prominent foodborne illness lawyer in America with his firm, Marler Clark, the food safety law firm, and also a major force in food policy in the U.S. and around the world. So, Bill, it's my pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for being here with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, the first question I want to ask you pertaining to the events around 1993 is, how did taking on and winning Breanne Kiner's case and the class action lawsuit against Foodmaker help shape the rest of your career? And, you know, also, what learnings did you take away from these cases on a professional and a personal level?
Well, I was a very young lawyer at the time. I'd been out of law school for just a little over 4 years when the Jack in the Box case hit Seattle. I actually was working at a defense firm at the time and was, you know, spent my time defending companies, not in food cases, but just in, you know, a variety of other matters and trying a lot of lawsuits. When the Jack in the Box case hit, I was a former client of mine who was friends with some of the victims, or one of the victims, contacted me, and I got permission from the firm to file the first lawsuit. And, you know, I went from having one client to 10 clients to 100 clients. And then some of the seriously injured children, including Breanne Kiner's parents, contacted me. And then essentially I became the by default, primarily because I offered to do all the work, I became the lead lawyer in the case, doing all the discovery and finding out, you know, all the issues in the lawsuit, which ultimately, you know, determined that, you know, meat that came from Vaughn's, the supplier, was highly contaminated with E. coli 0157H7, and that Jack in the Box consciously decided to ignore the Washington State food code regulations of internal temperature of 155 and decided to keep it to the U.S. Temperature of 140, and which that ultimately led to the outbreak. It was a combination of highly contaminated frozen patties and undercooking the hamburgers. You know, that the litigation, once all the discovery was completed and we sort of understood, you know, how the outbreak happened and, you know, what Jack in the Box and Vaughn's knew and when they knew it, the cases really started, you know, resolving. And, you know, ultimately, you know, the settlements, total settlements were over $110 million on behalf of all of the victims. Breanne's settlement was $15.6 million, which was a significant settlement in 1994,
right?
Early 1995. You know, to answer your questions, like, where did after that ended, I thought I would go back to sort of doing, you know, trial work and, you know, just being a normal lawyer. And then the Odwalla case happened, and I got referred a number of cases from lawyers around the country. You know, the Odwalla case led to referrals on other cases. And then we got salmonella outbreaks and hepatitis A outbreaks. And eventually in 1998, I decided to focus my entire career on food cases. So I hired Bruce Clark and his associate, Dennis Stearns. They had defended Jack in the Box. I hired them away because they were, frankly, the two most knowledgeable lawyers in food safety in the world. I hired them away, and we started Marler Clark in 1998. And that's what I've been doing for the last 20 some odd years.
And the rest is history. And, you know, so how would you say that, you know, those that the first cases that you took on with the Jack in the Box outbreak, and especially, you know, defending Breanne Kiner, how did all of these things, you know, we talked about how that affected the rest of your career trajectory. So on a personal level, how would you say, you know, just quick comment, how did that affect you? And how did that drive you as you built your career around?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think lawyers have a tendency to think that filing lawsuits and, you know, doing discovery and, you know, making companies pay changes companies' behavior. And I think by the end of the Odwalla case, I was pretty convinced that civil litigation, although it's the right thing to do for the victims to get them compensated and to be taken care of for the rest of their lives, because some of these children are horribly, horribly injured. You know, I think the civil litigation is as I've said to people, is a real blunt instrument for change. And it really dawned on me that I needed to do more. And I think it was, you know, frankly, just post Odwalla, you know, early in 97, 98, I started getting offers to speak at food conferences and industry conferences and government conferences. And I started to meet doing those things and started to meet people in the industry. And at the same time, you know, I was working with the FSIS USDA on the sort of the rollout of 015787 as an adulterant and how that was playing out. And was getting more and more involved in the legislation that many, many, many years ago was sort of that ultimately formed the basis of the Food Safety Modernization Act. So my job became less of a vocation mm-hmm. and more of an avocation. You know, mm-hmm. it really became sort of part of like, you know, all that I did, mm-hmm. you know, family vacations were sometimes around the speeches that I was going to give. You know, one time I took my family to New Zealand and Australia for almost 6 weeks, but we traveled around the countries, and I'd give a speech, and then we'd have a week to play around with the kangaroos, and then I'd give another speech, and we'd mm-hmm. do it. And so that's how my children grew up, you know, and so. It's been as I'm kind of towards the tail light of my career, it's been a real wonderful thing. I've met some really great people, both, you know, as clients, but also some really super committed people in industry, you know, very committed to food safety, and, you know, mm-hmm. some who are with us today and some who unfortunately have passed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so certainly a career of dedication from you to food safety and to, you know, as you said, advocating that message. Now, I want to go back to Jack in the Box. Now, as a result of the 1993 outbreak, Jack in the Box completely overhauled its corporate operations around food safety. Now, do you think that the way in which Jack in the Box responded to the crisis, you know, operationally speaking, set a new standard for the fast food industry?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think you can credit not only the corporate leadership to be smart enough to hire Dave Theno, mm-hmm. you know, who interestingly, and many of your listeners probably won't believe this, but despite the fact that I probably deposed Dave, I don't know, you know, 8 or 10 hours and, you know, made his life miserable, we ultimately became fast friends. And, you know, I had nothing but admiration from him. And I actually wound up being the speaker at his eulogy. And wound up in San Diego and wound up sort of re-meeting many, many, many of the people from the Jack in the Box outbreak. But yeah, I think the way Jack in the Box handled it, you know, and what they did post, you know, outbreak, and, you know, with the leadership of Dave, not only was, you know, a great shining light for the fast food industry, But I really think it, you know, is applicable to food safety, you know, across the board in all industries. You know, we talk a lot, Frank Giannis and Doug Powell and Chris Griffin and others talk a lot about food safety culture. Dave created it, Dave created it out of whole cloth at Jack in the Box. And I think, all industry, the food industry and other industries can learn from what Jack in the Box did. And I think it's been, as I've said to a lot of people over the years, I had one case against Jack in the Box, and I haven't had another one since.
After a quick break, we'll be right back. Michigan State University is leading the way in food-related education and research. This Big Ten institution offers an MS in food safety degree, taught 100% online. With curriculum grounded in the sciences, this degree program will help you develop critical thinking skills, increase your understanding of the science of food safety, food law, and advance your leadership skills to prepare you for any food safety challenges. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more.
Well, you know, there were also many regulatory changes and guidance that came out of this outbreak, such as E. coli being declared an adulterant in ground beef, the introduction of testing for E. coli in ground meat, the raising of the recommended cooking temperature for hamburgers from that 140 degrees Fahrenheit to 155, and the USDA's introduction of pathogen reduction and HACCP programs, among others. So I'm curious, how well would you say that these policy changes have served to improve meat safety from U.S. industry over the past 30 years?
So it was not like an immediate, like, flip the switch, when Mike Taylor stood up in front of the American Meat Association and said, from now on, E. coli 0157 is an adulterant, you can't sell it. The industry didn't take that well, and they sued, and they said the sky would fall, and meat prices would be like gold, and et cetera, et cetera. It took a while for all the pieces of that system that you've described, HACCP and testing and the recall. It took a while for it to work its way through the sort of the regulatory system, government system, and the companies as well as educating consumers about safe cooking techniques and handling techniques. It took a while for that to work, but here's the reality. And I think this is, frankly, the most important part from my perspective of the whole Jack in the Box, mess, is that from 1993 to about 2002, 95% of my law firm revenue was E. coli cases linked to red meat. After the ConAgra outbreak and recall in 2002, these outbreaks essentially disappeared. The recalls and the outbreaks disappeared. It's not that I don't have a hamburger case once in a while that has happened. And they're not that they're, it's not perfect. And I'm not telling people to eat raw meat, but they should cook it to 155 internal temperature. But the reality is that the industry and government and consumers made meat safer. I did not have a hamburger or allow my kids to have a hamburger until, the late 2000, about 2010, 2012. But, it's something actually I will order now. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that what the industry and government and consumers did, again, in this space of 0157H7 and hamburger, is completely applicable, across the board to, lots of other different food products. So I think I gave a speech with Dave Thino in front of, I can't remember the name of the meat group, but it was the 20th anniversary of Jack in the Box. And Dave and I, gave a joint speech together, which was very well received. by the industry. And because I think they understand the work that they did, and the fact that I'm, you know, saying that they did a good job, I think is maybe perhaps surprising. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, in 2002, I wrote an op-ed to the Denver Post saying, hey, if you hate trial lawyers, you know, clean up your act and put me out of business. And that's exactly what the red meat industry has done.
Well, yeah, that kind of leads into my next question is, so, you know, you've taken legal action against many companies over the years, and you always invite them to put you out of business. So my question for you is, do you see any common gaps or themes with those companies that you take legal action against, you know, things that would help companies take action to do better?
That's an easy call. Every single foodborne illness outbreak I've been involved in, companies have had the opportunity to fix the problem before it blew up. And, you know, granted, regulators and lawyers have the ability, have the unique ability, is after disaster happens, we get to look in hindsight. But there's absolutely no question that companies have warning signs before a disaster strikes. And I could, we could spend a day, I could give you examples after examples after examples. But, you know, a really good one is, you know, the Odwalla E. coli outbreak in 1996 linked to unpasteurized juice. They had been warned 4 months before the outbreak by the U.S. government that their juice was not fit for human consumption, and that they, the army wouldn't buy it from them. You would think that that would be kind of like a warning that maybe they need to rethink how they're doing something, but they didn't. And they kept selling it to pregnant women and kids, and, you know, boom, a disaster strikes. Every single outbreak I'm involved in, that I find that kind of thing. There's, you know, a failure to invest in a certain, you know, technology. There's a failure to, you know, pay attention to testing protocols. There's a failure to, you know, sort of reinvent yourself. And I think that's where, you know, food safety culture kind of comes into play, where the idea that you have a culture of people with direct connection to those that make decisions to talk about, hey, you know, the government won't buy our juice. Maybe we should rethink how we do this. Hey, Washington State has 155 degree internal cook temperature. The rest of the United States is 140. Why 155 and 140? Maybe we should think about why that's the case. Every single outbreak I've been involved in, same thing. And I think, you know, my takeaway for, or the thing I try to leave companies when I give speeches and on this topic, is that, you know, pay attention to the details. You know, that's the, kind of the concept behind HACCP. Pay attention to details and empower your employees to be honest about, like, what's going on, and in a way that takes care of your, all the things that you do as a company, which is, you got to pay attention to the bottom line. You got to pay attention to food safety. You got to pay attention to your, you know, shareholders, you got to do all this stuff, but you got to protect your brand, you know, and you got to protect your consumers. And those two things are, frankly, the same thing. So it's not that it's easy. It's easy for me to talk about it. I know it's hard, and I know it can be expensive, but, you know, it's better than being responsible for, you know, a child who gets E. coli 0157H7 from lettuce and then can't, you know, suffers HUS and now can't walk, can't talk, can't feed himself. So, you know, there's nothing that, you know, I can do as a lawyer. You know, I mean, I can get him a bunch of money, but the, you know, the company needed to protect their consumer before something like that happened.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously everybody at a food company is responsible for food safety. But, you know, given the example you talked about with the Odwalla outbreak and the warnings that they had received beforehand, you know, that sounds like something that would be more within the realm of corporate management to deal with. So I have kind of a follow-on question for this topic for you, and that is, you know, when you're looking at you know, these kinds of warning signs you're talking about that you always see in foodborne illness cases, do you generally think that more often those warning signs are things that require attention and proper communication by more of the top level, the corporate management, or is this something that you see also or often trickling down to, you know, kind of the food safety tech team or the line people? You know, if you see something, say something, like where is the disconnect? Where is the problem?
Sometimes that's hard to discern, but I can't tell you how many times, you know, I mean, I give, and actually it's been more during the COVID years than, you know, I mean before, but, you know, I probably do, you know, 15 to 20 speeches a year on food safety to government, industry, you know, academia. And it's always kind of funny when, you know, after a speech and I'm like on my way out the door or whatever, you'll have somebody come up and, you know, look around furtively to see whether or not anybody notices that they're talking to me and go, hey, I wish my CEO would been here and paid attention to this, because we've been trying to get them to do X, Y, and Z for years and they just won't do it. And so, again, I think this gets back to, you know, I teach have helped teach a course with my, as Frank Giannis calls me, his frenemy. I've been teaching this course with Frank for a while. Uh-huh. And, you know, and he's all about food safety culture. And again, I think it really starts at the top, like in any organization. The CEO, the board, the you know, C-suite people, they've got to be able to create an environment where, you know, food safety matters are brought to their attention. Mm-hmm. And they have to encourage people to do that. And, you know, people shouldn't be like, there shouldn't be fear in like, oh my gosh, you know, telling the company that, that there's a problem. Or, you know, I think if any of your listeners would just spend time, you know, grab 100 FDA 483s and, you know, read those inspection reports and, you know, look at like the ongoing problems, the leaky roof, the old piece of machinery. And, you know, you have to ask yourself is like, why is this the case? You know, who's not bringing this to somebody's attention to rectify that problem? And, sometimes what the government has done when there's been that really abject failure by the C-suite, you know, they've been bringing criminal prosecutions, either, you know, felonies or misdemeanors. I don't think that that's a perfect way of resolving the problem, is putting people in jail or fining them tens of millions of dollars, because I think you can solve the problem by creating an openness between the people who are making that food and making that system and the people who are going to be making the decisions about the direction of the company.
So, yeah, no, really good observations. Now, there's another thing I want to talk about that, you know, is related to foodborne illness outbreaks, and that is recalls. So there have been a lot of ongoing discussions about the need for recall modernization and better coordination between states and the government. So many people claim that it takes too long and it's too difficult to centrally alert consumers about recalls and to get contaminated food off of store shelves quickly enough. So from your point of view, what are some practical policies or steps that you think FDA and USDA and state agencies could put into effect to improve the recall process?
You know, it's kind of a complex question, and I think we all know that. It's a lot of it has to do with transparency, but a lot of it has to do with accuracy. And the real question is, we have so much better technology now, with you know, blockchain and RDF tags and whole genome sequencing, we have so much better technology to create a more rapid response to the risk of foodborne illness. And I think that, you know, there's a balance between that the FDA has and companies have between, you know, transparency and accuracy. You know, it, you know, are we getting the right food product? Are we getting the right manufacturer? Are we getting, you know, the right product off the shelves? Are we, you know, unduly, painting a wide brush? And I'll give you an example. The Leafy Greens Jack in the Box was the 2006 E. coli outbreak linked to spinach, where, you know, they called it, and appropriately, you know, coming up on 9/11, they called it their 9/11, mm-hmm. their Jack in the Box. And, you know, but if you remember back, you know, about 3 days before there was a recall, I sued, you know, the company that produced the baby spinach, and very specific company. And within a couple of days, the FDA recalled all spinach grown in America. So mm-hmm. you know, I was able to do it on a very surgical level. And I think that sometimes is the problem with, you know, especially in the leafy green industry, having accurate, transparent supply chains. So my long answer to your very good question is really that we just need to, you know, utilize the technologies that we have in a way that, you know, gets accurate information out to the public sooner rather than later, in a way that they can consume it. It's more difficult now for consumers to, you know, consume this information because it's coming at them, you know, 50 different ways on Facebook, on Instagram, on Reddit, on, mm-hmm. you know, the news. You know, folks like you and me, we pay attention to this stuff. So we know when, you know, a product's being recalled, you know, we know to look in our refrigerators or our pantries. Most people, you know, aren't necessarily paying attention to this kind of stuff. And I think that we need to do a better job on that. But a lot of big box stores, you know, grocery stores are, and restaurants are doing fabulous work with technology. I mean, you know, somebody, you know, and can push a button in the food safety department at Costco or Walmart, and it stops the ability for a product to be scanned. Right. At, you know, and so we have those abilities. It's just really kind of trying to figure out how to integrate it, mm-hmm. and get it out to the public in a way that the public can, in a sense, consume that information adequately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it'll be interesting to see the, you know, improvements in traceability technology. I think that mm-hmm. we're going to see some exciting advances there over the next, you know, decade or so, and that will certainly help. But, you know, as you said, rightly, the communication issue is also a problem. And, exactly. and you're right, you know, of course, we hear about, you know, all the what's going on with all the recalls and, yeah. you know, outbreaks and situations like that. But, you know, the average person doesn't hear about an outbreak or a recall until it becomes big news. And, you know, the vast majority of newspapers or the big news outlets are reporting it. So, and by then, you know, they may have already eaten.
Yeah. No, it varies too between like shelf stable products or mm-hmm. products that can be frozen. I remember many, many years ago, there was an E. coli outbreak linked to meat, and it was before the USDA used to do, they would do like the retailer, they say, oh, we're recalling meat from this retailer, but they would never say, you know, what the manufacturer, the other way around. They would say who the manufacturer was, mm-hmm. but not the retailer.
Right.
And I had there was an outbreak, and, you know, it was in a particular period of time. And then about 6 months later, somebody called me and said, I got E. coli, you know, here's my test, blah, blah, blah. And they clearly were a link back to that outbreak. And I was like, but you got sick 6 months later. And they're like, well, I heard about the meat recall, but I bought my meat from this grocery store. And it didn't click mm-hmm. that those two were connected. Yeah. And that's when the FDA or USDA started doing that retail list. And, you know, the FDA has been rolling that out as well. And I think that's helpful for consumers. But again, it's just more information coming at them like a fire hose that I think sometimes is, you know, difficult to, you know, work. But, you know, I think we'll get there. It's just, it's been a little bit longer than I think it should have been.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of on that note, so my last question for you today is kind of a broad one, but I would like to know, what changes would you like to see happen in food safety over, you know, let's say the next 5 to 10 years?
So, I mean, I think some of the, you know, top ones would be, I think that the meat industry, especially, you know, poultry, and need to embrace that deeming bacteria that can cause severe illness and death as adulterants is something that can be done. And specifically, you know, E. coli 0157 in hamburger and red meat, it worked. I strongly believe that, you know, FSIS should immediately declare salmonella an adulterant in chicken. They're making kind of baby steps in that direction. But I think they should, you know, get that done and we should move forward. I think that would solve a lot of the problem in the poultry industry. The leafy green industry, I think, is a much more complex thing, but I think, you know, we need a much more rigorous and cohesive work between USDA, FDA, and EPA in dealing with environmental contamination of growing areas. You know, we want to encourage people to eat fresh fruits and vegetables. But the problem is those fresh fruits and vegetables are grown outside, sometimes too close to a cattle feedlot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the water supply may or may not be as clean as it could be. But, you know, we can't make it zero risk, but we can do better at sort of coordinating the various acronym groups to get it together. And I think that would solve a lot of the leafy green, fresh fruits and vegetable problem. And then I think the final piece of the puzzle would be getting better at traceability. So if something, you know, is contaminated or there's, you know, beginning of an outbreak, that we can get, you know, accurate information out to the public. So, and it's not such a broad thing like all spinach grown in America or all tomatoes, you know, from everywhere, that we nail it very specifically. And I think, you know, if we did those three things, you know, salmonella as an adulterant, you know, dealing with environmental contamination, cattle contamination to leafy greens and fresh fruits and vegetables, and did better at traceability, you know, you and I would have to talk about some other topic other than my food safety stuff. So, which would be a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we certainly will, you know, keep an eye on things and hope that we see some of these changes come about in food safety over the ensuing years. But Bill, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today and to also give us your perspective on the events of the 1993 Jack in the Box outbreak and your role in, you know, fighting for the victims of that outbreak. And thank you again for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Bill Marler for joining us on the podcast today, and of course, thanks to all of you for listening. A very special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Michigan State University. Please visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more about their Master of Science in Food Safety. And as always, we encourage you to send us questions or suggestions to podcast@food-safety.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We're always excited to get your feedback. And please make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your feed. Just click the follow or subscribe button in your podcast player and presto, there they are. And while you're there, please throw some stars our way by rating the podcast, especially if you enjoyed it. It only takes a moment, and it's good for everyone. All right, that's it for us today. Our next and final special episode for National Food Safety Education Month will post next week on September 27th. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.